Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. In Boston federal court this week, actress Felicity Huffman became the latest parent to plead guilty in the Varsity Blues scandal. She's one of dozens of parents, coaches, and college consultants who have been charged with conspiracy, fraud, and bribery, all to help wealthy students gain admission to elite schools. The scandal has demonstrated not only the inequity of the college process, but also the pressure to submit the best application with perfect test scores, high grades, and the most activities. But how much do those accolades reflect what a student actually understands? What if students, answering the call to perform, aren't really learning? Those are some of the questions at the heart of a new book called In Search of Deeper Learning, The Quest to Remake the American High School. And joining me now is author Jal Mehta. He's also an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Jal, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Callum.
Could you start by just explaining what you mean by deeper learning and why it is so important in your estimation?
Sure. So deeper learning is understanding the underlying conceptual structure. So if we were thinking of a cell, for example, if you could label the parts of the cell, that would be relatively superficial learning. If you understood how the cell worked and what would happen if a piece of the cell was missing, you understand the system that underlies the cell. On your very own radio station, if you listen to Car Talk, the people who are calling in can sort of see the symptoms of their cars, and the guys see the underlying structure. So you're essentially listening in on a conversation between someone who has shallow learning and someone who has deeper learning.
I like that analogy, of course, because a click and clack have a lot of fun, too, while they're doing all this educating. And that seems to be an important component of what you write about as you describe successful and not so successful learning environments in your book, right? It was getting people to be engaged in the way that people might be on their favorite radio program.
Sure. There's a statistic out there from a student Gallup poll, which shows that 75% of fifth graders feel engaged by school, and about 32% of 11th graders do. And
it's a big
essentially,
drop.
Yeah, the longer students have been in school, the less engaged that they feel. And, you know, engagement, you could, there's sort of amusement park, arcade, Fortnite style engagement. But the kind of engagement I'm talking about is the kind of engagement that is necessary for doing real learning. You can't do significant learning without some investment in the subject. And so the best classes, clubs, extracurriculars, the best spaces we saw had created these cycles where students were developing knowledge and skill and at the same time becoming more invested in their domains, which kind of motivated further learning.
So I should say that you spent 6 years, right, working on this. You visited 30 schools, interviewed more than 300 teachers, administrators, parents. So this is a lot of time investment that went into this. But I guess what I'm wondering in part is whether the deeper learning that you're describing is really realistic in all settings, especially in public high schools. I mean, we've seen teachers on strike in West Virginia, Los Angeles. I mean, teachers complaining about not having the resources to do, I think, the kind of deep learning that you're describing. So is it even possible?
It's definitely possible. We saw it, as you mentioned, we went to 30 schools. Some of those were traditional public schools. Some of them were high poverty schools. Some of them were more affluent schools. And within all of those schools, you know, what we usually would do on our first day is we would just staple ourselves to the back of a student or two. And my co-author, Sarah Fine, and I would each follow one student for a day. And as we followed them through their classes, the chances were that there would generally be one, maybe two spaces which were intellectually lively, demanding, interesting, engaging, et cetera. So I'll give an example. There was a teacher in a high poverty school in Boston, actually, and he was teaching an essay by Ta-Nehisi Coates, which had appeared in the New York Times. And the students just spent the first day just annotating the essay, thinking about, you know, just trying to understand what Coates was arguing. And then on the second day, they debated the thesis. So this was an article about the use of the N-word. And so Coates' argument was there were times where it could be appropriate to use the N-word. It really depended on the context. And so the race of the speaker, the race of the listener. And so the students, who were mostly Black and Latino, were really interested in this argument. And so on the second day, they had a really firm fierce debate about it. And then on the third day, he said, you know, let's look at this thing. You guys have been taught in school that to write an essay, there needs to be an introductory paragraph, and there's a thesis at the end of the paragraph, and then all the other topic sentences should follow from that thesis. But hey, like, this guy's an essayist. It was published in the New York Times. This is an essay. There is no stated thesis at the end of the first paragraph. You have to sort of come to the thesis. So what do you make of that? What does that suggest to you about the forms of which an essay could take? So that's pretty conventional subject matter, but the way that the teacher did it really provoked some significant thinking on the part of the students.
That's a great example of taking sort of a contemporary piece of writing and connecting it in a very personal way to students. But I guess what I'm also wondering is, you know, the argument that that's just not possible in all circumstances. I mean, maybe there's some value to just doing, you know, by the book, rote learning, workbooks and whatnot, because, you know, when you get to a job someday, there's going to be, you know, drudgery tasks that you have to do that you don't like. And I don't know, one of the life skills that maybe you learn in high school is how to just go through the motions, and you're not going to love every lesson plan. I mean, what about that argument?
It's clearly true that you can't significantly learn anything without some parts which are kind of boring or prosaic. But there's this idea from my colleague Dave Perkins at the Harvard Graduate School of Education called playing the whole game at the junior level. And so Dave's idea is that, you know, if you take something like baseball, kids don't spend like a year throwing and a year catching and a year hitting and then say, well, we're actually going to play baseball in graduate school or beyond. You got seven-year-olds like trying to play the whole game of baseball. And then within that, they sure, you got to take your grounders, practice your layups in basketball, practice your scales in music. Like, there are some sort of prosaic things you need to do. You got to practice the parts. But the good teachers, the most compelling teachers that we saw, they pretty much always started with some sort of compelling question, project, product, something that really kind of caught the students. And then they taught the more prosaic stuff through that. So if they're, you know, taking up an issue with the local city council, through that you can work on letter, you know, how you structure an introduction. You can go over grammar. So there's a lot of ways to sort of learn the more basic stuff embedded within these arcs. And there's some evidence which shows that when you do that, the kind of level of understanding students have is deeper, and that is useful for them later in life.
So in your book, you sort of grant a certain amount of anonymity to the schools that you spend time in, and you group them into these categories that you give names to. One is the no excuses type of school. I'm asking, can you sort of explain what that is, first of all, but then also explain the observation that you make that a no excuses school might be really good at getting kids into college, but then not through college. What's the gap there about getting in but not completing?
So no excuses schools, as folks probably know, are schools like the KIPP schools, Achievement First, Uncommon Schools. So these are schools which have been known as having very strict behavioral codes and, you know, really close control over students' time. So you'll see a lot of timers sort of counting down the minutes before a particular task is over. And there's been a lot of controversy about the discipline in these schools, and particularly when you have mostly white adults and mostly Black and Latino students, it makes people uncomfortable. On the other hand, people have said, yes, but these schools, they do well on the state tests, and that they send the kids who graduate from those schools to college in high numbers, which also seems to be true. And so what our study did was, by examining one of these schools in depth, we watched the school as they were grappling with the question of, we got our students to college, but once they got there, they really struggled. And the reason that they struggled was that college is a very open-ended environment. And so in high school, someone had been kind of watching every minute of the student's day and essentially sort of like forcing them to learn. And in college, those kinds of constraints weren't there. And students were really struggling with the kind of open-ended environments of college. So the schools were trying to think about how they might reorganize themselves to give students more agency and self-direction, but they kind of built their whole model on a picture of control, and their model produced the test scores, the funding, the public acclaim, all the things that they were known for. So they were sort of caught. They didn't want to undo the things that had gotten them that far, but the things that had gotten them that far were the same things that were causing the students to struggle in some ways at the next level.
Huh. There's another category of school that might be familiar to a lot of listeners. You describe it as attainment high. These might be affluent suburban schools around Boston. Think, you know, Lexington, Brookline, Newton. And you spend a lot of time in schools like this as well. High test scores, high college admissions, high completions, by the way, as well. But we also see a lot of students in those schools struggling psychologically with the pressures that they feel. In fact, just in 2014, there were three students in the Newton public school system who committed suicide. I mean, that's perhaps an aberration, but I think it's symptomatic of something you observed. Can you describe what you were seeing there?
Yeah. So we did spend some time in schools like that. And I think the main thing, and this connects to the intro you gave me about Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, was just sort of this emphasis on performance over learning. So Carol Dweck, the psychologist at Stanford, sort of says there's, you know, doing a task because you're trying to get the mark, and there's doing a task because you're sort of trying to work through the problem or the thinking. And so at these schools, there were posters about Dweck's research all over the walls, which said things like, you know, your next mistake is your first opportunity for learning, that sort of thing. But if that's what was on the walls, what it was in the water was like, you better get a 98 if you want to get into the right college.
And your mistake can be the 2 points that you missed on that.
Exactly. On that, yeah. Exactly. So I think the sort of the feeling that we got at such places was that both students and teachers had been kind of conscripted into a game which had been created by the pressures of the parental community and the college admissions offices, which it wasn't really clear that either wanted to be playing. The teacher said things like, you know, I would like to engage students in what you're calling deeper learning, sort of grappling with complex questions, but I feel like I'm being received as an opponent, someone who is a gatekeeper who will provide the credential or not. And then the students said, well, the teachers ask us questions, and in theory, they're open-ended questions, but in practice, they know that the answers that they want. And a student gave an example of, we were watching Dead Poets Society, and then after Dead Poets Society, there was a PowerPoint with the takeaways we were supposed to take away, which he said was the exact opposite of the point of the movie.
Right, so, the sort of irony there.
So I think that there's room for parents to be sort of play the role of kind of wise, humane adults and ask students a little less, what did you get, and a little more, what did you get excited about and interested in? There's definitely a role for colleges to rethink their admissions procedures and broaden the criteria a little bit.
So Boston Public Schools has a new superintendent coming in, Brenda Caselius. Based on all the research that you've done in the course of this book, in the moments we have left, what kind of guidance can you give her in this new job?
I think it would be that we have schools that were constructed at the beginning of the 20th century with the goal of efficiently batch processing students, not really with the goal of significantly engaging them in thinking about complex and important and personal and meaningful questions. And so I think if I were her, sort of the most significant thing I would think about is sort of what are the opportunities for those schools and the communities around them to give students access to those kinds of questions? What are the opportunities for students to take some agency and control over their learning?
Jal Mehta is an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of In Search of Deeper Learning, The Quest to Remake the American High School. Jal, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Cal.
Stay with us. Coming up, Elizabeth Warren says she won't appear on Fox News. Smart move or divisive politics? I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.